This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we welcome back to the program a fellow who calls himself an economic naturalist. His name, Robert H. Frank. His latest book is The Economic Naturalist's Field Guide, Common Sense Principles for Troubled Times. Frank says by getting a handle on a handful of economic principles, we can be better decision makers individually and collectively. Robert Frank is a professor of management and professor of economics at Cornell University's Johnson Graduate School of Management. There, as a way of capturing his students' interest and helping them retain the material taught, he invites them to pose and answer questions that illuminate how economic principles work in the real world. In the classroom and through his writings, Frank encourages us to join him in thinking like an economic naturalist. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for our guest, Robert H. Frank. Join our discussion with your questions and comments. We look forward to hearing from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The Economic Naturalist's Field Guide, Common Sense Principles for Troubled Times, is one of several books written by our guest. It is published by Basic Books. It's a collection of our guest's columns, most of which originally appeared in the New York Times. Our guest's website is www.robert-h-frank.com. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Good to talk with you again. How are you?
Very nice to be on again, Celeste.
We last spoke in July of 2007. So much has changed. What are your observations in general about the economic downturn and the policies that have been put in place to date to try and turn it around?
You know, the downturn is by far the worst one we've seen since the Great Depression. In fact, during the early part of the downturn, output and employment were falling more rapidly than even during the worst of the downturn and the beginning of the Great Depression. So this one looks like it's going to be one of the ones people will be writing about for a long time. What's different about this one compared to the one we faced in the 1930s is that we at least have a pretty good idea of how best to respond to an economic downturn. So I think we've seen really very vigorous responses both in the fiscal realm, the big stimulus package that was passed in the spring, and in the monetary domain. Ben Bernanke, the Fed chair, has been taking extremely aggressive action to pump up the money supply and get credit out there. So if the downturn ends up being less severe than many feared, I think it will only be because we had at least some notion of how to respond to it. Mm.
Do you think this deep recession will lead to stronger social safety nets, or is it endangering them?
You know, I think we look here to Rahm Emanuel's comment, you don't let a crisis go to waste. It's long been apparent that the U.S. social safety net has been allowed to deteriorate beyond any reasonable level. It needs reform. We're the only industrialized country that doesn't have universal health care. Pension security is lower here than in most other industrial countries. I think now we will see serious attempts to reform the social safety net. There are legislators in Congress, apparently with coalitions big enough to bring the votes to bear to enact a meaningful health care reform plan. I think we'll see Social Security propped up. We'll see some reform steps taken to slow the growth of medical expenses. Yeah, I think we're in a position now to take some of the tough choices that we've avoided for recent decades.
Yeah. At the same time, the states are really struggling. That's why I asked, are we seeing, you know, social safety nets in danger?
Well, for the time being, absolutely. Yes, I think one of the big things that's compromised our response to the downturn is that unlike the federal government, which doesn't face a balanced budget requirement in any given period, of course, there's pressure to balance the budget over the long run, states are under legislative requirements in many cases to have balanced budgets year by year. And so when you're in a big downturn like we're in, tax receipts fall, that means the states are under a legislative mandate to cut their spending, and that's exactly the wrong thing to be doing if you're trying to climb out of a downturn.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Robert H. Frank. We're talking with him this afternoon. His latest book is The Economic Naturalist's Field Guide, Common Sense Principles for Troubled Times. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have a listener already lined up waiting to talk with us, so let's go and take a call. Listener in Elgin, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Celeste and Robert, I guess.
Yes.
You know, I'm kind of worried. I mean, a lot of people out there are really scared about this whole spending spree. I've had a chance to pull up some of the parts of the budget for this country, not only the country but the states. And there are things on there that have nothing to do with any of us as far as taking care of us, as far as getting the job done. It's basically spending money on roads, on parks, on monuments that maybe we should put away for another time, you know, like a rainy day or something. And that's what's got me scared, is because they're not paying attention to us. You know, it's hard for me to balance my budget at home as it is now if these guys aren't doing it. They're responsible for this country being in a downturn, and I can't understand why they're blowing us off. I mean, spending isn't going to help it. I've disagreed about the way they go after, for instance, we're going to own car companies. They just said it on, I heard the news, that the government is going to be owning a big stake in GM, Chevy, you know. And this is after the fact that our president has said he wasn't going to do that. We're not in the business of doing it. Why didn't they let him fail?
Okay, I'm going to
reorganize.
Okay, I'm going to butt in.
Okay, yeah, we got some lively questions.
Yeah,
there.
Many questions.
Yeah, there have been some who've said that spending won't help get us out of the downturn any quicker. The consensus among economists is that the first priority is to take steps to increase spending at the national level. What we know is that the reason we're in a downturn, the reason unemployment's poised to go over 10% soon, is that people aren't spending enough. Why aren't they spending enough? Well, consumers have been spending beyond their means for a long time. They were propping up their spending by taking out home equity loans based on artificially high house prices. They're not going to be able to spend at the same level they were in 2007, so consumption spending is going to be down for the time being. Private investors, they're not going to spend much in the next months. Why? Because they've already got enough capacity to produce more than people want to buy at the moment. So those are two of the biggest components of the economy, consumption spending and investment spending, both of them stalled well below normal levels. The one remaining component of national spending that's significant is government spending. And what we learned from John Maynard Keynes in the 30s was that when you're in a deep downturn like the one we're in, the only actor on the scene with the means to take effective action to raise total spending is really government. And if people are building roads or fixing them, that's good. That's a useful thing to do. The bad road surfaces in the U.S., are way behind on maintenance. They cause about $120 a year worth of damage to every car and truck on the road in this country. Fixing them, a good idea. Building parks, that puts people to work too. People get paid to do those jobs. Then they go out and they spend money on groceries. They spend money on food. So the recipients get those dollars. They spend them. And we have the now familiar multiplier effect. That's what the government strategy is here. And it's really the right one. As for GM, I certainly see reasons for being very disappointed in GM's management over the last decades. They had lots of opportunities to embrace more fuel-efficient cars and cleaner cars. They lobbied against those provisions at every turn. Your impulse may be to say, well, they managed poorly. They deserve to fail. Well, in a certain sense, they did fail. They've filed for bankruptcy now. There's been a complete wipeout of shareholder value in GM. They're being restructured now. I hope they'll emerge as a successful company. they've shed a lot of the inefficiencies that they were saddled with over the years. I think there's a good chance they'll emerge in a leaner, more efficient form. But if they're going to fail, way better for them to fail 3 or 4 years from now than during the midst of the deepest downturn since the Great Depression. So I think the president's done the right thing, really, to give GM a chance to file for bankruptcy and emerge in a leaner, more efficient form.
Okay. Does the caller want to follow up?
Yeah, real quick, I wanted to say, yeah, you're right. I actually hope it turns out better. I mean, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, but I hope it all turns out in our benefit because we all need this country is better than what we're going through. But I want to make one real quick comment.
No one knows how it's going to turn out. That's the interesting thing. We're in uncharted territory at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing I could tell you in my case, and this might not be anybody else's case, that the amount of taxes I'm paying in this state, I've lived in other states because of my career, it's just overwhelming. And I've only got 4 more years on my mortgage, and right now the way I'm basically being taxed out of my house because the way the economy is gone, the business isn't there, and so forth. And I'm sure there's a lot more people worse off than me. But you know, my fear is that in the end, my kids are going to be thrown with this bill. And that's what I'm really concerned about.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
Okay. I think that, you know, that's a question that a lot of people are asking at the end of the day. How do we pay for it?
Yeah, we certainly don't want to raise anybody's taxes now. Right now, there's not enough spending. If we raise taxes significantly, that will cause people to spend even less. That's not what we need. It's absolutely right, though, that we need to raise more revenue if we want to do the things that have been proposed that we all think should be done. You know, if you want universal health care, if you want high-speed rail to be built, if you want to develop green energy technologies, there's a lot of investment that has to be done, and we can't pay for that with money borrowed from the Chinese. Once the downturn's over, we're going to have to figure out how to raise money to pay for it ourselves.
Let's take another call. A listener in Decatur on line one. Hi.
This from Decatur?
Yeah. Hi.
Okay, I didn't hear you say with the static. I got a comment about the thrust of the spending. I'm not anti-spending. I do think it's entirely inflationary. But rather than waste it on parks and stuff, I think we ought to be able to be spending it and focusing it on competitiveness for the USA against the world. Because one of the things we need, and we're lagging far behind, is on mass rail transit and improving our rail system. That would make us far more competitive by lowering our costs of transportation. So I guess if I were running the show, I would ask the railroads how much rail steel do they need to expand passenger service between, let's say, you know, various points around the country, concrete ties and so forth, and start buying that now while the steel is cheap. Mm. You wait and put that off for a few more years, steel's going to get expensive because China's going to be gobbling it up. So it seems like to me that that's where our priorities ought to be, is go ahead and buy the stuff, stockpile it, and then start laying it. And I'll listen to what your comments are.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, what a great proposal. The idea that we could really profitably invest in some of these areas that you mentioned is spot on. One example, there are a couple of bottlenecks on the Northeast Rail Corridor. The Harbor Tunnel going into Baltimore is one, and there's some overpasses that are at a low height at several other junctures. Because of those bottlenecks, we can't send double-decker containers by rail up the Northeast Rail Corridor. Instead, we have to send them on trucks up I-95. Now I-95 has gotten so congested that trucks are diverting onto I-81 200 miles west. Night and day traffic, noise, fuel, fumes. If we fix those bottlenecks, the estimate is it would cost us $6 billion to do that. That's a lot of money, but the estimate of the benefits, the immediate benefits from doing that, not even counting any benefits from reduced global warming contribution from greenhouse gases, would be $12 billion. So we can afford to do that. We ought to start work on that tomorrow. It would put people to work. It wouldn't put our budget in more difficult situation going forward because we'd actually be making more money than we'd be spending by doing that. Yeah, and your idea for buying up steel and the railroad ties now while they're available cheap in a depressed market, that's a great idea.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Is that me?
That's you.
All right. Thank you, Celeste. I agree with your theory that Keynesian economics applies here, but I guess there's a competing theory of Milton Friedman, among others, to let the free market take care of itself, and it will eventually regulate itself and, moreover, correct itself. Now, my problem with this is that if all of these theories worked out in a pure, sterile environment, I guess Americans would not be so confused. But we don't have that here. We have two major parties, one of which, the Republican Party, in my opinion, has decided to do whatever it can to obstruct the success of the Obama administration. And they created these conflicting messages that I think in these distressed times has caused all kinds of anxiety, frustration, and confusion with the American populace. And that bothers me with the 24/7 cable news, especially Fox News. And I just wonder, was this same thing going on in the Great Depression? And did Franklin Delano Roosevelt, like President Obama, had to deal with these arrow flamethrowers in trying to get his economic recovery through?
Yeah, those are good questions. Roosevelt had much bigger majorities in both houses of Congress when he took office. And so I think the need to negotiate, the need to try to craft bipartisan agreement on what to do next was much less pressing in Roosevelt's case than it is when you've got a president now with majorities but slimmer ones. The stimulus bill got zero Republican votes in the House of Representatives. It got three votes in the Senate from Republicans. So really the Republicans have not been eager to step forward and cooperate with the president's stimulus program. It's discouraging, I think, to people who are watching. The House leadership called a press conference and denounced the stimulus program as a mere spending program. And if you look at the idea behind the stimulus program, that was the whole point of it. The whole point is that we don't have enough spending right now. Consumers aren't going to spend more. The private investors aren't going to. Government's got to step in and fill that spending gap. So to object that it's a spending program, well, that kind of misses the point. Of course, it's a spending program.
And yet they exploit these slogans. For example, you know, the jobs numbers for the last month were disappointing. And yet the next day, Republicans and John Boehner, the House leader for the Republicans, they had this ad out with a hound dog looking and saying, where are the jobs? If you don't have a job, you're in pain. I think politicians do a disservice to those who are really suffering, and then they're not suffering, who are using this for political means and ends to score cheap political points. And I think that really causes a lot of confusion and frustration within a suffering population.
Sure. Sure, we got a political system that could use some reform. I think that's true. The Senate is a real bottleneck. Now people feel you need to have 60 votes to pass even the most minor legislation. Otherwise, it goes to a filibuster. Mm-hmm. That was never the intent of the founders in setting up the Constitution, to have everything be filibustered. That every little piece of legislation you might pass would need 60 votes. I think, yeah, the time's really ripe to think about how to reform that aspect of Senate legislation.
Within the body of this caller's comments, I'm hearing frustration, stress, pain, and a point against the media here as well. At a community meeting I attended recently, the economy was the topic, and one man said, among other things, he said, losing a job is like a death in the family. And another thing he said is, in essence, when it comes to telling the story about what's going on today, we need to discourage panic and turn our attention to what we value. What do you think?
Well, first of all, losing your job is like a death in the family. There have been studies showing that it's the most stressful condition to be in. If you're long-term unemployed, your odds of attempting suicide are about tenfold what they are if you have a job. Mm. So, yeah, I don't think anybody should have any doubts about the fact that increases in unemployment on the scale we've seen have been absolutely devastating to tens of millions of families.
So then I guess what we need to do together is to support one another.
That's right. Yeah, and the fact that the safety net is worn thin here makes it much more difficult in the U.S. than it has been for families in Europe, where unemployment benefits are generally more generous, where universal health care is the rule in every country. So I think it's been easier for people to weather this storm in Europe. But, you know, we're having lively discussions day by day about reforming the safety net. So I think, you know, that's the task at hand, really, to figure out how to keep this from happening again.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for his call. We're going to take some more calls. Let's go next to Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to go back to a question about taxes and funding, funding new government initiatives, kind of related to the tax question that a caller a few calls back, specifically with regards to how we might pay for an insurance plan, either a single payer or other national product. There seems to be a loud cry against how we will pay for this, a question about the tax burden on the individual. However, I'm not hearing much discussion of the exchange of costs that may happen with certain types of restructuring. So currently, workers are paying a percentage of their income for their premiums, and employers are paying as well. If these are eliminated from the cost for employees and employers going to private companies, wouldn't a similar financial structure complete much of the cost? Could you speak more about exchanges that may occur in response to the claims that we may simply see a higher tax rate?
That's a great question. One of the basic facts about universal health care systems as they're administered in other countries is that, well, there are two basic points. Everybody's covered. Here we have more than 47 million who are not covered. The second fact, though, is that even though everyone's covered, those systems spend anywhere from half to two-thirds per capita what we spend on health care. So if we move from the current system, which has an enormous amount of churning in it, a lot of the money that's spent in our system is spent by insurance companies hiring people to resist claims that have been filed by patients and doctors. Another big chunk is spent by insurance companies trying to identify and avoid writing policies for people who have risky conditions. The private insurance market is just a bad model for providing health care to a nation. No other country relies on it. We wouldn't rely on it ourselves if we had started from scratch. It was an accident that pushed us into the system we have now. The good news is that if we were to switch from the current system to one like the systems in place in the other industrialized countries, the total bill would go down. So, yes, your taxes might go up. Instead of paying out of lost wages to finance your health insurance provided by an employer, that might be instead pay for out of some of your tax payments, but the total amount you pay one way or another would be lower.
Right. That's kind of my question. Right now I receive about 68% of my income with all of the deductions that I have going toward various expenses
right.
in addition to my tax base, where if I wasn't paying 4 to 5% of my income toward my insurance premium, wouldn't that 4 to 5% at least cover my portion, my family's portion, perhaps, of the national
yes.
program?
Absolutely.
And why am I not hearing more conversation about these exchanges, where this restructuring would lead to an exchange of cost, not an increase in cost?
You know, when we have a debate in this country about a big policy issue, the terms of the debate seem to be shaped by what can fit into a 15-second or a 30-second soundbite. So we'll see brief sensational ads running on radio or TV saying that the government's going to take away your right to choose your own doctor, or the government's going to ration health care, or it'll just be brief scare messages. You know, to have an intelligent conversation about it takes 30 minutes. That's not a long time, but we don't seem to fit 30-minute discussions into our national political debate very conveniently.
Well, perhaps you can work harder to put them in our private debates. Thank you very much.
We need more Celeste shows.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to Kankakee, line four. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. The stimulus plan, I'm totally in favor of it. I think Keynes was right, you know, a long time ago in England. And I think they need more, and I'm glad to see people coming out of the New York Times the other day saying that we do need more stimulus. My concern is that to this point, it's my understanding that they've only spent about 10% of the $7.5 billion of what the first stimulus was going to affect. And why haven't we spent more of that money? We can't expect a recovery if you don't spend the money.
Yeah, it's a good point. And one of the reasons there has been skepticism about stimulus packages like this for a long time has been that recessions are usually pretty short. And by the time you get stimulus money into the pipeline and out usefully at the other end, the recession's often over with by then, and you're adding to inflationary pressure by the time the extra spending
happens. I don't think that's the case this time.
So that's why I think the Congress was willing to enact such a big stimulus program this time, because all the projections that were on the table when Congress acted were to the effect this is going to be a long, deep downturn. If the money doesn't get spent until 2010, it's going to do plenty of good then, too. That said, I think we really do need to take whatever steps we can to get more stimulus money out quickly. The easiest thing to do in that domain would be to have a bigger flow of revenue sharing going to the states and local governments that are now forced to cut their budgets mm-hmm. back because of balanced budget requirements.
Yeah, look at
Illinois. We see teachers laid off, police laid off, hospital workers laid off. You know, that shouldn't be happening.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. It seems in the past we've had revenue sharing in other downturns. How did it work at the time?
Well, I mean, you have to take specific measures in Congress to authorize new funds to be directed to states and localities. There is revenue sharing in the stimulus package. There's not enough revenue sharing in it. The number needs to be bigger, basically. Congress should go back for a second bite at the apple and make that number bigger. Because the good thing about revenue sharing is that it has an immediate effect. You know, you've got a policeman about to be laid off. You pass the bill calling for additional revenue sharing, then that government knows, well, we don't need to lay those people off. We can keep them on the payroll.
Yeah. What lies ahead for states like Illinois? We're here 9 days into our fiscal year, and we do not have a budget. What lies ahead for states like Illinois, California, also in very dire straits? What lies ahead as our leaders try to make their way through this political and economic thicket?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough times ahead. There is some doubt that Congress is going to move aggressively to try to get an additional stimulus thrown into the mix. If that doesn't happen, then I think we really do face pretty dire fiscal straits at the state level. Yeah, it's going to be 50 Herbert Hoovers essentially working against the efforts of the federal government to stimulate the economy.
Mm. Robert H. Frank is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a professor of management, professor of economics at Cornell University's Johnson Graduate School of Management. He's the author of a number of books, the latest, The Economic Naturalist's Field Guide, Common Sense Principles for Troubled Times. It's published by Basic Books. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phones and take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
I think part of the problem is you have those Republican governors that's all around in different states and things are not doing what they're supposed to be doing with that money. And the majority of them wants Barack Obama to fail, just like Rush Limbaugh told them to make sure that he failed. So they are not, they rather see the country go down than to see him in office. You know, they are some hateful, low-down, dirty people. I listened to Rush Limbaugh. I'm not listening to a couple of days because he ain't there. Somebody else there. But I remember the first day that he wished that he would fail. And you see a lot of the senators and the congressmen, that's not, I don't think it's all political. I think a lot of it's got something to do with race, too. They just don't want the man to do well. Thank you.
Yeah, it sure does look like there are some opposition voices that are hoping for the government to fail. Yeah, I think that's in the long run going to be a very bad posture for Republicans to adopt. I don't think the voters are going to reward them for that posture. There's a lot of skepticism, just like we heard about open desires for the government to fail when we're in the biggest crisis that we've confronted in so many years. But there are apparently those who explicitly say they hope he fails.
Let's take another call. Listener in Charleston on line two. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to just comment about the guest's statement that, you know, it's hard to get intelligent conversation, meaningful and honest. And my comment is on a commercial I saw using the same scare tactics that the guest was talking about. And they're under the group, a nonprofit group called, I think it's Conservatives for Patients' Rights. And the scare tactic immediately offended me, so I tried to dig as much as I can. And I'm not sure that all this information is accurate, but from internet sites like Watchdog or Watchgroup.com, they've reported that the major contributor of those commercials and that whole nonprofit organization is a man named Richard Scott. And he apparently was the CEO of a large chain of hospitals that was under investigation by the FBI. And eventually they ousted him from the CEO position and fined that chain of hospitals. Columbia was part of the designation for the hospital chain. They fined them $1.7 billion, and this is according to some websites, I'm not sure how accurate, $1.7 billion for overcharging Medicare and Medicaid. And it feels like most of the opposition comes from people who stand to lose money because of the oversight that might catch them in some of these fraudulent Medicare overcharges. I guess that's my comment. So my question is, how is it the government's responsibility, or, I mean, is it up to the private citizenry to make this conversation that we're having, this debate, legitimate and honest and get that kind of negative lie, I would just say it's outright lies, propaganda, though, out of the discussion, because it's not helpful. And when you know who is voicing it, it becomes even more spurious to me. I don't know if you can comment on that or if I was just venting, but thank you.
Well, it is frustrating to see the conversation driven by narrow commercial interests. We do, however, have a fairly strict constitutional free speech requirement in this country. You can't really deny someone the ability to buy airtime and put out pretty much whatever messages he or she chooses, as long as it's not blatantly libelous. And so, you know, I think it's up to people who want to see meaningful reform to organize forcefully and get their message out. You know, we've seen some wonderful examples of good political communication in the last election cycle. You know, that the level of debate's been raised enormously, in my view, compared to what it was in past campaigns. And I think the fact of small donors being willing to make collectively huge funds available to move that debate along has been just a really, really encouraging development.
I want to thank the listener for his call and invite others to join us this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In this latest book, this collection of writings from you, Robert Frank, you have a chapter thinking about health care. And one of the things that you say about what stands in the way of fixing what ails our health system is opposition to raising additional tax revenues, and two, opposition from private insurers. And this second obstacle is interesting because, as you say, you know, the first step here, I'm quoting here, the first step is to acknowledge that insurance companies are not evil and that should not be put out of business overnight. That would be unjust. So what's the way around that obstacle?
Yeah, this gets to the point that your earlier caller from Urbana made. The insurance companies have an interest in staying in business, obviously. Mm-hmm. They organize their health insurance businesses in a fully legal way. This was just the way it was done in this country. If we put them out of business overnight by switching to a different system, they will lose hundreds of billions of dollars. You could say, well, that's just the risk they took by going into a business that the government might enter. But the real practical problem is that insurance companies in the past have demonstrated enough political power to block meaningful health reform. I think that's what we saw in the 1993 effort to reform the healthcare system. The insurance companies had enough political muscle to stand in the way of meaningful reform. And if they do, and that's the only way to get reform, then what I argued in the column you mentioned is that rather than not get reform at all, it would be better to share some of the gains from reform with the insurance companies to ease their transition out of that business. Do we need to do that? I don't know. I don't know how many votes there are for meaningful health care reform in the face of insurance company opposition. So that's something I think the political leaders in Washington are probably thinking about.
Let's take another call, a listener on a cell phone on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment because you guys were talking about the stimulus money and going to the money going to the states. Well, you know, Illinois has stimulus money to hire employees, state employees, to administer the food stamp program because, you know, the food stamp rolls are people trying to get on food stamps because they're losing their job, and that money's tied up. The state will not hire people, even though they got that money. They could be hiring at least, you know, 100 people to administer the food stamp program, and they're not doing so. So, you know, I don't know how you get, you know, them to shake loose that money because it's not money that they need, you know, to appropriate from the budget. It's stimulus money. So somebody needs to shake them up and have them release some of that money so people can get hired and those people can start paying taxes.
This sounds like a good job for an investigative journalist. Somebody needs to find out who's holding things up in that arena and write a big article about it. Let people focus their attention
right. So
on
maybe somebody there on your radio station would like to look into that because that's a real problem.
Yep.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, economist Robert H. Frank. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, credit certainly has tightened up a lot. Is it here to stay, tighter credit?
You know, I think if banks were more cautious in the loans they made going forward, that would be on balance, a very positive development. The level of vigilance banks were exerting over their lending in the last couple of years was just ludicrously low. They were issuing what they called among themselves liar's loans. They didn't ask you to verify your income. They didn't go through any of the usual steps designed to verify your creditworthiness. They just lent you the money and then sold the loan to some sucker down the line. So, yeah, to the extent that we enact new regulations that keep that from happening again, we can't do it quickly enough.
Yeah. We have been through an era of deregulation. Are we on our way to a period where we will see more regulation?
I think we will, yes. I think for the last three decades or so, we've been hearing a lot about Adam Smith's invisible hand, the idea that when you turn greedy people loose and tell them trade for your own advantage in private markets, you'll see once the dust settles, you get the greatest good for the greatest number. You know, it's a great story, and sometimes it works exactly as described. You know, the businesses do compete with one another for the trade of customers. They have incentives to introduce low-cost products and better product designs. And the competition does force profits and prices down so that in the end the consumer really does benefit substantially from all of that. There are many cases, though, where market competition doesn't produce good outcomes. And here I think we looked at Charles Darwin, who had a slightly different view of the competitive process than Adam Smith did. So what Darwin said was that evolution shapes traits because they benefit individuals. Whether the traits benefit larger groups or not, well, that's a secondary question. That's not what evolution's primarily concerned about.
Yeah.
So sometimes the traits that favor individuals, selfish individuals, help the society as a whole. That's true, but not always. You see lots of examples. The credit market is one where when each individual acts in his own best interest, you get a horrible situation for the group as a whole.
Maybe you would share with us quickly the gist of a column that you wrote titled, Why Do Hockey Players Feel They Need Helmet Rules?
Oh, it's a timely question. That's a perfect example of a situation in which the individual's interest adds up to a whole that's not very attractive to the group. So this is actually a point that was originally made by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Thomas Schelling. And the question he asked was, why is it that hockey players, if they're left to their own devices, will never wear a helmet, yet they will vote in a secret ballot unanimously for a rule requiring helmets? He wanted to know, if helmets are so great, why don't you just wear them? So his answer was that if you're an individual hockey player and you take your helmet off, that gives you a slight competitive edge. Maybe you can see better, hear better, or maybe you're better able to intimidate players on the other team because you're crazy enough to skate without a helmet. So that means your team has a better chance to win. Others don't sit idly by in the face of that. They take their helmets off, too. And so by the time things settle down, you see everybody skating without a helmet. Everybody runs a higher risk of injury. Nobody gains a competitive edge. Much better, people reason, to vote for a rule requiring everybody to wear a helmet. Then you'd have no competitive edge for either side also, but at least people would be at much lower risk of injury.
Let's take a couple of more calls here, or try to. McLean County is next. Line one, hi.
Hello. You were mentioning the title of the book. Would you mind mentioning some of the principles that you say would help the country and individuals as well? And I will listen offline. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good question. If I had time to mention only one, which is probably how much time I do have, I would mention the granddaddy of all economic principles, which is the simple cost-benefit principle. It says you should do an action only if the benefits are at least as great as the costs. It sounds totally simple. How could economists spend their time thinking about such a simple idea all the time? It turns out to be harder to apply that idea correctly than it seems. And so there's a little bit of experience you need to gather. You have to sort of see it done in situations where the correct application might not seem intuitive to you. But if you see that one simple principle applied correctly often enough, I think that's the one thing you could learn that would make your life turn out way more advantageous for you and your family.
Okay, let's take one last call. Listener in Chicago on line four. Hi.
I talk about invisible hand and benefits and costs. Recently there's an expose in the Rolling Stones magazine about the manipulation that goes way, way back of the hierarchy in our economic system, principally, they've referred to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and other big companies that are wheeling and dealing to the point where it's no mystery anymore because of the expose about how we're being undermined. You know, they want the profits and benefits without realizing the costs and ramifications upon the rest of the world. We've got that economic tsunami that's occurred, and who knows how we're going to bail out of that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. If you've got people who are manipulating the market, then you don't get the benefits that the market promises. That's for sure.
Okay. There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Robert Frank, thank you very much for joining us today.
Celeste, thank you so much for having me on again. It was a pleasure.
Robert H. Frank is a professor of management and professor of economics at Cornell University's Johnson Graduate School of Management. His latest book, The Economic Naturalist's Field Guide, Common Sense Principles for Troubled Times, is published by Basic Books. You'll find our guest online at www.robert-h-frank.com.